Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts. Hey everyone, this episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Libro.fm. As you know, we at Books and Boba are strong proponents of supporting your local independent bookstores, but unfortunately, due to obvious reasons, it's been hard to get out lately. That's where Libro.fm comes in. Libro.fm is the first audiobook company to make it possible for customers to purchase audiobooks through their local booksellers of choice. They offer over 150,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers, and hundreds of bookseller recommendations. And each purchase goes to support one of their 1,100-plus independent bookstore partners. Audiobooks are a perfect way to work through that TBR list of yours while doing chores, walking the dog, or just staying safe at home. All you need is a smartphone with the Libro.fm app. Listeners of Books and Boba can get a 2-month audiobook membership for the price of one by going to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter the code BooksandBoba. With each listen, you can take pride in knowing that you're supporting your local bookstore as well as Books and Boba. Again, to access your 2-for-1 promo deal, go to Libro.fm and enter the code BooksandBoba. And now to our show.
You're listening to...
Whoa!
Potluck.
Potluck. You're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today to talk about our July 2020 book club pick, The Widows of Malabar Hill by Sujata Massey. Rira,
yes.
Congratulations. You've made it through another month of 2020. How do you feel?
Congratulations to you as well. It's been more or less the same. I cannot believe that it's going to be August.
It feels like August, though. Because it's getting hot, but I get it. I think you and I both are, I guess, rule followers in terms of, like, we're not really taking any, like, excess risks by going out. Like, we don't have, at least for me, I don't feel the need to have to eat out at a restaurant. I'm perfectly fine with just getting takeout and eating at home.
Yeah, same here. Yeah,
I feel like you know, sometimes it just feels a little futile because I know there are people out there who are taking, not even like, there are people taking calculated risks, right? Like, okay, we want to get out because we're getting stir crazy. Let's go find a restaurant that does outdoor seating with the strictest regulations and have fun. But I also know there are a bunch of people who aren't being careful. And those are the people that are going to make all the sacrifice that we made these last 5 months mean, you know, nothing.
You mean like that TikTok party? Did you hear about
that? No, what happened?
I don't know TikTok or YouTube celebrities. I'm sorry, kiddos, but I just don't dabble in that world anymore. but Tyler Oakley, I think he's like a YouTuber. He pretty much like called out a bunch of TikTokers who went to this humongous birthday party, and they were like, there were like over 50 people there, and nobody was following social distancing, or like some of them weren't wearing masks. And it was just like, you irresponsible people who thought that like a birthday party was worth, you know, like sacrificing, like you said, 5 months of social distancing for everybody else. Like,
yeah,
it was incredibly selfish. And there was really no formal apology. like the person who threw the party was like, oh, I'll do better to follow social distancing. And it was like, that doesn't really show remorse or acknowledging what you did wrong.
I mean, it's just a basic boilerplate, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's enough bleak news. Instead of talking about the future, we're going to be talking about the past. The Widows of Malabar Hill. It's a historical murder mystery. I really like this book. It seems like a lot of people in our Goodreads forums liked it as well. Marvin, do you want to go ahead and read the book jacket description?
Yeah. So the description of the book is as follows. Bombay, 1921. Parveen Mistry, the daughter of a respected Zoroastrian family, has just joined her father's law firm, becoming one of the first female lawyers in India. Armed with a legal education from Oxford, Parveen also has a tragic personal history that makes her especially devoted to championing and protecting women's rights. Mistry Law is handling the will of Mr. Omar Farid, a wealthy Muslim mill owner who has left three widows behind. But as Parveen goes through the papers, she notices something strange. All three have signed over their inheritance to a charity. What will they live on if they forfeit what their husband left them? Parveen is suspicious. The Farid widows live in Purda, strict seclusion, never leaving the women's quarters or speaking to any men. Are they being taken advantage of by an unscrupulous guardian? Parveen tries to investigate and realizes her instincts about the will were correct when tensions escalate to murder. It's her responsibility to figure out what really happened on Malabar Hill and to ensure that nobody is in further danger.
So before we start the discussion, trigger warnings, domestic violence, victim blaming, sexual harassment, and discrimination. Also, spoiler warning, since this is a murder mystery novel, I highly recommend that you read the book and then come back to listen to this episode.
Yeah. So, Rira.
Yes.
What do you want to start with this one?
I think we should start with the author's background and just like the inspiration behind Parveen. So Sujata Massey was born in England and she was raised in the U.S. Right now she lives in Baltimore and her parents are from India and Germany. So she did a lot of traveling. She actually wrote another mystery series back in the 90s, which was set in Tokyo while she was living in Japan. And it's the Rei Shimura mystery series. But this book was more in the realm of own voices. She did an incredible amount of research for this book. I don't know if the people in our Goodreads forums read the acknowledgments at the very back, but I tend to read all of the acknowledgments because I'm usually really curious as to who the author thank. And it gives me like a sense of their journey when it came to writing the book. And she, Massey doesn't have a background in law. She reached out to a lot of people. She reached out to legal historians at universities, both in the U.S. who specialize in South Asian law and also in Bombay. She contacted magazine editors who are familiar with Parsi customs. She actually went to Mumbai and she visited all of the historical institutions. She reached out to like even railway experts so she could figure out like how people were able to travel from one place to another. And even with the food, I think she interviewed a bunch of like food writers as well. So like the food descriptions in this book are fantastic. And our main character, Parveen, is actually inspired by two women attorneys. One of them was Cornelia Sorabji. She was the first woman to read law at Oxford and the first woman to take the British law exam in 1892. 1892, that's a lot earlier than I would expect the first Indian woman to study law. And yeah. The other woman that Parveen is based on is Mithan Tata Lam, who also studied law in Oxford and was the first woman admitted to the Bombay Bar back in 1923. So, Parveen, this book is set in the 1920s. So,
yeah.
Yeah, so it's really interesting that it's actually based on women who did practice law so early on.
Yeah. I mean, it's I don't think Rira and I can claim to be experts in the cultures of India. But this book really, you can tell that the author did a lot of research, especially to portray like Mumbai/Bombay during this time period, which was like pre-partition. It depicts a Mumbai that's very multicultural, very multi-faith, like a lot of different people, customs, cultures, religions, and even value sets like kind of coexisting with each other, which made for a really interesting setting, especially in the context of Parveen and her father, Jamshedi, as lawyers who had to, you know, navigate these waters, right? Because every single community has their own set of laws that they have to understand and know how to argue. And this also takes place under the backdrop of, this was when India was still an imperial colony, right? It's still part of the British Empire. And so you have the added wrinkle of a colonizing power in the form of white people in the mix as well.
Yeah. Like you said, I'm not an expert with 1920s India. But in terms of like England, 1920s, so that was during George V, who was the grandson of Queen Victoria. So it's two reigns after the Victorian era. So it's not he, very.
He's the dad of the King's Speech King, right?
Yes, yes. So this was during a time where there was a rise in socialism, and just, I think it was like at the height of the British Empire, and then it crumbled.
I would say probably it would be the beginning of the decline, right? Because this would be post World War One. Europe is pretty much in ruins, right? Economically, definitely, right? And I think because of the costs of fighting the First World War, England's power over the world starts to decline.
Yeah, and also like this is when other monarchies start to fall. So this is like the fall of Russia, fall of Germany, and England is pretty much like the only monarchy, only European monarchy left.
Yeah. So the story takes place in this very unique time period where there's a lot going on. And I think the setting is probably one of the most interesting things about the book. But at its core, the book is also still a murder mystery, right? It's this type of mystery is termed like a cozy mystery, much like the one we read a couple months ago.
Mimi Lee gets a clue.
Yeah, where I guess, can you refresh my memory of what a cozy mystery entails?
So a cozy mystery, like obviously, you know, obviously the mystery is like a main storyline, but it's more based on the character, more based on like the atmosphere of the setting, for example. So it's not really violent and it tends to be a little bit more slow paced.
Yeah, because in this murder mystery, the murder happens, I want to say, like
pretty late
through the book. Yeah.
Yeah, I was really surprised. I was like, when I was reading it,
I thought it was going to be about who killed the patriarch of the family.
Yeah, me too. I was just like, I'm around like at the 70 page mark and the murder hadn't happened yet.
So when it did happen, it kind of caught me off guard because I wasn't expecting an actual murder. I thought this was more of like, was Omar Farid poisoned by one of his wives or his caretaker? But that's getting a little ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, because like, you think that the murderer is the patriarch, right? But then it turns out to be somebody else entirely. And
right.
Yeah, it was just really surprising. And I actually really like the fact that that Parveen, like she is doing a lot of investigative work, but it's so entrenched in like litigation and law and how to be creative in terms of like getting interviews with the widows. Like, how far can you go within the realm of law in order to solve this mystery? And I thought that was like really interesting. You wrote in our notes that Parveen was kind of like Phoenix Wright in a way.
I mean, the whole story reminded me of like, so for people who don't play the video games, Phoenix Wright is a series of, I guess, detective slash legal visual novels by Capcom about a hapless defense attorney who does the impossible to get his clients, his innocent clients, acquitted, right? And a lot of like, there was one specific scene where I was like, aha, that's Phoenix Wright for sure, where Praveen is in real, like, is talking to one of her clients, one of the widows, in a car, and she was like, aha, a contradiction, and then presses her on it. I was like, oh, that's definitely a Phoenix Wright move right there.
I thought it was a really creative way to set up this mystery, because none of the male investigators can talk to the widows because of the law of Purda. The widows are not allowed to talk to other men. I guess they can talk to other men, but they have the right to refuse, and men can't touch them. They have to stay hidden. And this is a custom that is followed by Muslims in Mumbai. And I just thought it was interesting that Praveen, who also lives in Mumbai, like who is born and bred in Mumbai, is kind of still unfamiliar with the custom. And yeah. I was really blown away by the level of diversity in the community.
Yeah, I mean, like even within her own household, like, her family is Parsi, which is, I guess, the term Indians use for Indian Zoroastrians, which is like a Gnostic faith that comes from Persia, right?
Yeah, it actually predates Christianity and Islam. So it is a very, I think it's like one of the oldest religions in the world that is still practiced today.
Yeah, it's a Gnostic, monotheistic religion. So it's similar to Christianity, but some of the customs are a little different.
And even the way, there's like a scene where Praveen visits the house, the Fareed mansion, and one of the children of the widows, they remark like, hey, why are you wearing your sari wrong? That's like one scene where you realize like, oh, there's a lot of diversity and India is not just a monolith. And I thought it was a really interesting choice that Sujata Masi made by making Praveen a Parsi.
Yeah. But also like the time period that this takes place in, right? Because this is pre-partition, like it was when India still was the entire subcontinent. They hadn't like divided it up between, you know, Muslims and Hindus. I mean, I think showing everyone kind of living in relative harmony might have read a little unrealistic, but at the same time, I did believe this world where, you know, people were very tolerant and or understanding of everyone's different beliefs, right? And that comes from the people in power too. There was a scene where the lawyer, the counsel of the governor of Mumbai, was talking to police to figure out how to get fingerprints of the three widows in the house where the murder happened, and basically advising them, you can't go in and force them. That will cause a major incident and that will cause unrest, right? Because of like perceived attacks on religious freedom or religious customs. So, you know, it shows a world where a lot of people, like where there are a lot of different cultures intersecting and colliding, but also people who understand like those differences, which, you know, it was nice to read about. I don't know how realistic that really was. And again, like I wasn't there in the 1920s. It could have just been like this, which makes it really sad because I feel like these days the amount of harmony has decreased, or at least that's my read on it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like there's definitely been a decline in just like tolerance in general. And that's not just India. Like it's any country that has suffered from colonialism. You see that in China. You see that in... like you see that in other Southeast Asian countries.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of this, and I think, especially in South Asia, right? A lot of that has to do with the fact that there are now borders separating people, right? Like in this book takes place both in Mumbai / Bombay and Kolkata / Calcutta, which is on the border of, currently on the border of India and Bangladesh. But again, during this time period, there was no Bangladesh, I think Sujata Massey was really smart to set it during this time where you could see all these interlocking systems. In addition to, right, this is when the British were still here, right? So you also have that layer of imperialism, colonialism, and the fight for self-rule added into the mix, which will probably lead to some additional juicy cases.
One of our Goodreads members, Clara, said, I've been reading Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers' Golden Age mysteries, and while I find them sort of soothing, the number of times a racial or anti-Semitic slur comes up was kind of wearing. Widows was a nice, cozy mystery that was mercifully free of and quite critical of the casual British racism. And I definitely agree. That is a thing that bothers me a lot when I read mysteries that are set in the 1920s and also just in India or any colonial country. It's just like, ugh.
Yeah. And even the one cop that was a jerk, or the cops that were jerks, weren't
okay,
racist
one cop,
jerks.
No, it was like the entire police force, Marvin.
I like the sub-inspector Singh.
Yeah, sub-inspector, yeah. But he was such a jerk in the beginning. And the only reason why he was nice to Parveen was the fact that she's the only person who could interview these widows. And I thought it was just really interesting how, like, when Parveen, she hears about these widows who are living in seclusion and who might be abused by their keeper. I don't know what the actual title
it's
is.
The
but
household
like their,
agent, I think is what they call
yeah,
them.
The household agent. In her perspective, she thinks that the women are kind of living poorer quality lives. But as the investigation goes on, she realizes that because of the Purdah laws, they don't have to be fingerprinted. They can refuse to talk with the police. They can't be compelled to go to court. They don't have to give testimonies. These are all things that these are all things that were within their rights. And in a really weird way, in this patriarchal setup, they have power. And I thought that was really interesting. And the fact that I will get into this a little bit more, but Parveen also was forced to be in seclusion, even though she has all of these rights as a woman, as a female solicitor.
Well, I think that's what gives her pause when she reads about, you know, the fact that the three widows were donating their entire inheritance to the family charity, which it's a waqf, right? Which I think is like a sort of foundation that the family runs, right? Because she's seen the way that cultural laws, not just the laws of the land, but like cultural laws can oppress women and have oppressed women. So I think it's justifiable the way that she is immediately suspicious, right? Because it's happened to her. Like she, and I think we can get into it, like this story is a dual narrative, right?
It's an origin story.
Yeah, it's a dual narrative in terms of it takes place in two time periods, right? There's a flashback portion interspersed between the murder mystery in present day, quote unquote, 1921. And I don't know if this is how this next book is going to be set, but there's still half the origin still missing, which is how she became an advocate for women's rights, right? Like we know she is, but when we leave her at the end of that origin story, she hasn't gotten there yet, right? She's taking charge of her life, but she hasn't decided what direction that life is going to go.
One thing that surprised me was how progressive her parents were, especially her father, Jam Shetty. Because he, throughout the book, you see how supportive he is. He is actually like advocating her to go to law school to become the first female solicitor of Bombay.
I mean, and isn't that just a typical Asian parent, though? You gotta be a lawyer to, you know, have my love.
Well, the thing is, it's like during the 1920s, and there aren't other female solicitors at this time in that city. And there were very, very few female lawyers in India. So I thought it was really progressive and surprising that her father was very insistent that she go down this path rather than getting married at the weird normal age, which was like, what, 14, 15 years old?
Yeah.
In their community. And just, I had to look it up because I was a little bit skeptical, to be honest. I was wondering if Parsi parents were actually this progressive. And it turns out that Parsi parents in the 1920s were that progressive. They were advocates for their daughters to study in education, law, or medicine. And a lot of the wealthy Parsi parents, they did send their kids to Oxford, to schools in England. And
well, not all Parsi parents are progressive.
Well, I said wealthy Parsi parents. And you see like divisions in the Parsi community as well, the Orthodox Parsis and the ones who are a little bit more modernized. And I thought it was really interesting that I thought it was really interesting because like the Mistry family, they are in this weird privileged position because the Parsi fortune has been built upon colonialism. Like the family, they run a construction company and they built all of these buildings for the East India British Company. It's just like a weird contrast. I keep saying weird because it's not something that I expected, because Parveen is definitely for India self-rule, but she understands that her privileges are based in colonialism.
So here is a central tension that I kept reading while reading this book, which is, I mean, there's this, you know, conflict between progressive ideas and traditional ideas, right? And it made me think about, because we've been thinking a lot about colonialism lately because it's been a big topic of discussion, but how much of those progressive ideals come from Western thinking? The idea of things like science, medicine, rationality, how much of that is like because of colonialism? And the idea that colonialism brings progress to backwards places, which is like the justification of colonialism and the British Empire in general, right? And I find myself in conflict with, like, if India wasn't a colony, would Parveen even exist as she is now? Would we have, like, even the rule of law? Like, they're practicing British law, right? In conjunction with Parsi, Bengali, a Muslim law, but...
which are all different, by the way.
Yeah, but the system of, you know, law, as in courts and barristers and things like that, that also probably comes from the English system. And you find it hard to condemn the whole thing, but would there have been another way to spread progressive ideals if it wasn't forced upon them?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing when cultures combine, right? Like, that's the positive aspect. You get the best of both worlds, but also like one part is going to be oppressed.
And I feel like part of what's making me uncomfortable is you don't really see the conflict of colonialism, right? You don't see the brutality. You don't see the violence of colonialism in this book, because it's not part of it. It's not that they're not interested in talking about it. It's just, it doesn't come up, right? Because like we said, Parveen, the Mistry family is essentially like upper class. Like they're not aristocracy, but they are part of the system. Like they've benefited from the system. They enjoy privileges. Like they live well. They live in mansions, right? And I guess class conflict isn't a central part of this book, but I can't help but try to like grasp at it while reading it, you know?
Yeah, like you said, like I do wonder like what India would have been like if British law wasn't introduced into their system, and how like that works in conjunction with family law.
Not just British law, but just like medicine, science, like,
yeah, like medicine and science. Yeah. It is a conflicting view, because like, for example, like Jamshedi, Parveen's father, you know, he's very progressive in terms of getting his daughter to have this top-notch education and this job. But at the same time, he's like, don't walk alone. You're not allowed to do these things unaccompanied. And even in the terms of like the contracts with the widows, he is kind of dismissive about it, even though he you know, defended his own daughter in her separation case in Calcutta.
I mean, much like Regency era England, like Austen era England was very like all about decorum and etiquette. This 1920s Mumbai was also very much about decorum, etiquette, maintaining your honor as a woman.
But that's not specifically Victorian. That I feel like in all patriarchal societies, that's always going to be the case. Like, women don't have agency. They're not allowed to. The people who read Convenience Store Woman last month, like, I really do wonder what your thoughts are on this book. Because the criticism of last month's book was the misogyny and the sexism and how that really brought a dark cloud in the book.
Yeah.
Like, this book was, like, 100 times more dark in terms of women's lack of rights and just customs in general. I think I will have nightmares about the red room, about the menstrual seclusion room. It was really unsettling to read about, like, how Parveen and how her in-laws were enforcing this really, like, archaic, orthodox custom.
Yeah, definitely. Like, while this book definitely pulls its punches when it's talking about colonialism, it pulls no punches talking about the misogyny of traditional orthodox views that were prevalent in India during this time period.
Yeah, and even in communities where, like, seclusion is not part of the culture anymore, the culture, like, the thought pattern of menstrual is considered dirty and you should be ashamed of it, and just, like, the shaming of it is really unsettling to me. And I read this book while I was on my period, so it was like double unsettling, and just I was just like, I would die in a room like that. And just,
I mean, someone did die in a room like that.
Someone did die in a room like that, and no one helped her. And you see this division in the Parsi community, who, you know, they seem to be really progressive. Like, legal separation, that is a thing. Divorce is a thing that is allowed. I mean,
but you're not allowed to divorce if your husband is with a hoe,
a prostitute.
Yeah,
yeah.
That is allowed, apparently, under the law.
And just, like, how Parveen got venereal disease.
Yeah.
And, like, that was considered, I mean, like, there was definitely a lot of victim shaming.
Right. And even the idea of a venereal disease was so, so foreign, right? Even within Parveen herself. And she definitely is still kind of coming into her own confidence during the present day parts where she is, you know, standing up for herself. But in the origin story, like the saga of her quitting law school because she was being bullied by all the boys who think that her being there will diminish their degrees, I felt real bad for her, but I understood why she was fed up, right?
I was actually really surprised that she quit law school.
Well,
because, like, you know, this is about her path to becoming a solicitor. So I thought she was going to stay in law school. But then once she quit and she got married, I was like, how does she get a law education?
Well, I mean, that's her journey, right? And they put the seeds that, like, she is obviously not with this guy anymore. But, I mean, the Parveen of 1916 would have done that, right? Because that Parveen has a lot of internalized, when she's being abused by her mother-in-law, she takes it, like, internally, like, oh, it is my fault, right? When she first gets diagnosed with a venereal disease, with gonorrhea, she thinks it's her fault somehow. Like, how could I have possibly gotten this disease? When, like, anyone, like, all the readers, even for the doctors, like, it's pretty obvious where you got it from.
Yeah.
You know?
And, oh no, like, with the whole in-law situation, that was really hard to read. Just the suffocating nature of it. How Parveen couldn't, like, there's a scene where Parveen, she wants to go to the local college. And she has the money. She doesn't need financial support from her in-laws. But they said, but the college says you need permission from your husband and even your husband's father.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, I was just like, how her husband, who was initially quote unquote supportive, because he turns out to be a fucking con artist. He was the fucking worst.
He's also very dirty. So many STDs on that boy.
Oh, man. I mean, he got syphilis at the end, and I was just like, you're going to die.
Yeah.
And I'm totally okay with that.
What did you think about his last attempt at gaslighting her at the end?
Of him being like, hey, you should kill me?
Yeah.
I don't know if that was gaslighting.
I think it was.
I think it was just like, I'm in so much pain. Please kill me. Like, please have mercy.
He wanted her to do it, though, so that she could feel bad. That's my theory.
Okay, well, that is a viable theory. But, like, just the way her in-laws treated her and how the rest of the Orthodox Parsi community treated her. They were just like, hey, you're rich. You're spoiled. You don't know how to cook. You don't know how to do any of these womanly duties. So, therefore, you're lesser. That was just really hard to read for me. It was really traumatizing. And trauma is a really big theme in this book as well.
Yeah. I mean, she's obviously traumatized by the whole experience. She's always jittery when she hears broken bottles. She is instantly suspicious of a lot of men.
With good reason, because yeah. A lot of them tend to be very bad people.
Yeah. And, you know, you can see how these experiences turn her into the type of lawyer she is in present day /1921, as someone who, even when she's like, her inner monologue is scared, she puts on a strong front, right, to stand up to patriarchy and misogyny when it's being presented to her. I mean, the only time she was really caught off guard was when she was kidnapped for like a chapter. But even then, she was very rational, right, in thinking, like, how do we get out of this?
Yeah, yeah.
She was still in control of what she could be in control of, which I feel like is something that you learn to do when you're in situations where you're not really in control of a lot of things. Focus on what you can control and figure out the solution.
Oh, okay. So, like, since we talked about young Parveen, what were your thoughts on her whole engagement and her path to getting married?
I mean, I was suspicious of the dude right from the jump.
Yeah, right from the get-go,
But at the same time, I think it's more that they foreshadow a lot of the drama that's going to come up. Like, they foreshadow the fact that, like, she gets jittery when she's around broken bottles. And so that painted a picture of, like, domestic violence. So, like, during these flashback sequences, I was kind of bracing myself for when the shoe was going to drop. Because you see cracks in the facade from the beginning, right? When the mother is shown to be a very orthodox and very controlling person. You see the small signs that, like, and I think the book does a really good job showing obvious signs of abuse and of infidelity and of gaslighting that anyone can see except the person experiencing it, right? Because a lot of times I was like, come on, Parveen, you're smarter than this.
Yeah, but she's also 19 years old.
And yeah, she was definitely taken advantage of, right? She had this very romantic notion, you know, the dude was charming and on paper, it seemed like a good love match, but she's definitely oblivious to her privilege, right? Like, she couldn't fathom that, like, there were any other reasons why his parents would be so eager to have him marry her. And I think that was the first red flag, because she didn't conform to that list that his parents wanted for him.
Yeah, like, she wasn't 15, which is so gross, because Karush was what, 28? When,
yeah,
like, that's almost 10 years apart. The fact that, like, Parveen, she pretended to be pious in order to get her potential in-laws to like her, mm-hmm. it is such a common thing, because like, women in patriarchal societies, they are kind of taught to cater to other people's wishes. And I thought it was also, like, really interesting, because the custom at the time is you let your parents decide who you marry. Like, that is, like, the typical way to go. Like, your parents know best. like love comes after marriage. That is a way to build a successful relationship. And Praveen's like, no, we fell in love. And, you know, like, let's not do this antiquated romance. And it turns out that her modern romance doesn't work. And it's just like...
Well, I think part of it is just she was afraid that if she waited, his parents would just arrange something for him. And then they would have no chance. So there's also that sense of like, you know, they were obviously in that initial infatuation phase where she was like head over heels. And like during that time, she feared that it would end. And so made this rash decision that like, yes, I want to marry this guy that I just met a month ago.
Yeah. And then the parents were like, oh, you need to get married in like 2 months. And you have to get married in our town because it doesn't match with our schedule. And that was like another red flag. Yeah. Because it's like, it's the bride's wedding. The bride's family is going to pay for everything.
And I guess it shows how, I guess, progressive Jamshedi is also that he didn't just say, no, what do you, like, I refuse. That he was like, well, if this is what you really want, I don't like it, but I will support it.
But in hindsight, he should have been like, no.
I mean, Jamshedi is a very practical man. He seems like the type of person who like, yeah, go F up and I'll come save you when you need me, right? Like, go make your mistakes, learn your lessons, and then if you need me, I'll always be there. And I think as much as he probably wasn't like father of the year, he was always there for his daughter.
Yeah, yeah. I would say like that trial scene in Calcutta was it was the most suspenseful part of the book. It was more suspenseful than when Praveen gets caught by Sakina, who turns out to be the murderer, and she's trying to like weasel her way out. Like, I felt more tension in that court scene because I really wasn't sure if she was going to get the separation, even though she wasn't with Karush in the 1920s chapters. Because in my mind, I'm like, well, like, did they grant legal separation, or is she just living with her parents in like this unofficial separation?
Right. Because
like, are the parents going to ever call her back? Like, is her husband involved in the kidnapping? Like, there were a lot of questions. Yeah, I mean,
that was the implication, right? Because one of the subplots was that she got the feeling that Karush was in town and that someone was following her. And so that was always like kind of in the background of, okay, here's a secondary thing that is a clear and present danger, but I need to be a professional to follow up on my job. But, you know, for us, the reader, we were always reading for, okay, we know that there's this like crazy ex-husband out there somewhere who is really mad and a giant dick, right? And at the end, it turns out that he's super sick from syphilis and about to die. So he's of no danger, really. But it's kind of that Schrodinger's cat thing where before we knew that, that was always a danger for her that was out there.
I think it was a really good red herring. So like we've talked more about her abusive relationship with her in-laws. And we did mention like how that story seemed to be more compelling than the actual murder mystery. But we should talk a little bit more about the murder mystery.
Like for me, I thought they were actually equally compelling. I was interested in the origin story, but I was really interested in the mystery that was unfolding as well. I mean, one is a story about escaping an abusive relationship, and the other is like your traditional murder mystery, right? And
but it's also escaping an abusive relationship because their household agent is abusing them. He is swindling them of their money. He is lying to them. He's not letting them know their rights. He's able to pretty much do whatever he please without repercussion.
Yeah, I mean, that's the setup, right? But the actual execution of the mystery part was kind of like a boilerplate mystery. And it turns out it wasn't a crime of like self-defense against an abuser. It was a crime of passion, right? Unless I'm reading that wrong. Am I reading that wrong?
No. I think you're right. Because it turns out that Sakina and Mr. Mukri, who is the victim, they're cousins and they were in love. And she finds out that
he's been lying to her.
He was lying to her, right? It wasn't just the fact that he was stupid and he didn't understand how the whole financials.
No, she found out through Praveen's consultation that he didn't have the authority to do the things that he was promising her. Because it turns out her sister wife, Raiza, is the Mutabali,
executor.
Is the executor of the waqf. So, like, basically he's been lying to her, which made her really angry.
Yeah. I just, like, wonder, like, what was Mukri getting out of it since he couldn't get the money from the waqf?
Well, that's why he was having them donate all their money to the waqf so that he could start his boys' home.
His school. Yeah, his, like, boys' boarding school.
I think was actually a slush fund for himself.
But then how could he get the slush fund, though? Because he is not the executor of the charity. He has no control over the money. That just made me think, oh, he didn't read the fine print well enough. Like, I thought he actually thought he could take the money somehow when he had no rights to. Like, he doesn't have any power in terms of, like, getting the money.
Hmm.
In any case, he lied.
He was also forcing them to sign things and...
Yeah, he did forgery and stuff like that. So, yeah, maybe he would have gotten the money. But I think it was a really interesting setup with Praveen doing the private consultations, because you find out that each wife doesn't have all of the information. They have secrets from each other. And while they seem to live harmoniously, there's definitely jealousy. There's definitely, you know.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I think that's what I meant when I said, like, the mystery part of this was pretty much like it's your typical murder mystery, only instead of being set in, like, some country home in, like, England, it's set in multicultural Mumbai. I feel like the pieces are the same. But the way they interact is different because of, you know, the purdah and because of the way that colonial law and Parsi law and Muslim law are intersect here. But at its core, you have one, a giant house with secret passageways. You have people who aren't forthcoming with their secret relationships to each other. And you have a lot of conflicting agendas, right? So, I mean, in essence, it is your murder mystery, just in a setting we haven't seen before. But the fact that it takes place in a literal clue house was pretty, I thought it was pretty awesome when, like, Praveen was going over the floor plans with Alice and, like, discovering that, yeah, this is literally a murder mystery house, except in the Muslim style.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting as well. I think someone in our Goodreads forum had mentioned it seemed a little bit unbelievable when Praveen didn't insist on finding Amina, the daughter of Razia, when she went missing.
I can believe it in the fact that she probably... I mean, Praveen definitely takes her job way too seriously. And so I can see that her devotion to client, like, attorney-client privileges would cloud her judgment there. I mean, it was definitely a bad move, but not, like, I don't know if it was unjustified.
I don't think it was unjustified. And they did mention how if they report that a girl is missing, that girl's reputation might be tainted forever. And it might ruin their chances of getting married. So I did find that part justified.
Yeah,
but it was.
I feel like Amina's the type of girl who probably would be okay with that.
Yeah, and but, like, the thing is, like, so much time had passed. I think it was like 3 days that has passed, and they didn't find her. And eventually, like, John Shetty was like, "We need to involve the police in this because a child is fucking missing for 3 days. Who the fuck knows where she is?" That part, I was like, kind of wish Praveen did that. Like, I kind of wish he was like, okay, like, enough days have passed. Like, we need to talk to the police.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it's still in character, though, because she is technically still very inexperienced and very, like,
impulsive.
I mean, even with all her, like, external confidence, very unsure of herself the entire time. it never felt like she was ever really in control. She was just making a lot of snap just decisions based on what she, and she noticed a lot. Like, she was a very good investigator, and she's able to, like, again, catch the contradictions between, like, what people were telling her in a very, you know, Phoenix Wright style. But
she was a very,
also much like Phoenix Wright, she was also kind of bumbling for a lot of the story.
Yeah, she was definitely bumbling a lot, but she, because she was such a good lawyer, that made her a good investigator, because lawyers, they have to follow up on the paperwork. They have to interview possible witnesses. And she did that. She went to the market to figure out if Mosin, the guard, actually did go by Rosewater. And she notices that it wasn't Rosewater, it was Sandalwood. And that's what made her believe that there was an affair. And it was really nice that she was good at her job, because the police were very bad at their job. It was just like the way they dismissed her and the way she, you know, followed up on a lot of these clues and leads, and the police just being like, you're a woman, you're not even a real lawyer, you can't represent your clients in court. Why should we?
Well, they were all like, yeah, we caught the guy already. Case closed.
Which is something that happens in modern day. Like, police now, police now, they just want to catch anybody if the case goes on for too long.
Yeah, the cops were very, the cops weren't good at their jobs.
They were bad in investigating, and they were bad in terms of, like, not knowing customs and how to, like, get around that. They were just, like, bad in every single area. So it was really nice that Praveen was good at her job.
Yeah. What did you think about her partner?
Alice?
Her Watson?
Alice was, well, first of all, she's queer.
It was refreshing to see, like, the white person as, like, the sidekick.
Like, it was nice because, you know, she seems to be very progressive. Like, it sounds like she is for India self-rule, and she wants to immerse herself in the culture, because she actually was born in India, and she grew up with, like, an Indian nanny, grew up with the food.
Yeah, I mean, she's an ally, but she also does some, like, white feministy things.
Oh, like, yeah, she's definitely, like, her mom is the worst. Her mom is, like, the worst Karen. Worst Karen ever. And Alice definitely has moments where she forgets her privilege. But it's nice that towards the end of the book, she uses her white woman privilege for good.
Yeah.
But like you said, it was really nice that, you know, we have a white sidekick, and it wasn't the other way around.
And I like that they showed that they were, like, they were probably each other's support when they were both at Oxford, right? And I think both are marginalized in their own way. You know, Praveen, obviously, because she is Indian, and Alice, because she is queer.
And also a woman.
I thought they were going to kiss, though. I was waiting for that scene.
Oh, you thought it was going to be a queer romance?
The seeds were there.
The
I was like,
are there.
Because obviously Praveen is over men. And I don't know if I read it correctly, but I think the gonorrhea did make her barren, right? Or sterile.
Yeah, they said, like, she can't have children anymore. But I don't know if it was just like, oh, she's diseased, so no one wants to be with her, so therefore she can't have children.
Yeah. I guess I don't exactly know how gonorrhea works. So,
well, like, gonorrhea, like, obviously it's curable now.
Mm-hmm.
It's curable now. Like, you just have to take, like, medication. There's obviously complications if you have gonorrhea and you're pregnant.
Yeah, but I read that the implication was that she went undiagnosed for a while.
Oh, yeah, for, right? Like, a long while. And that is the difference between the Orthodox Parsi community and the modern Parsi community. Because her mother-in-law is like, just, I don't know what fucking cure she thought of, but like, it was like, stay in the red room forever. And
like, yeah,
and then like
much.
Her mom, like, and like Praveen's mom, she's like, we have to go get you to a gynecologist, like an actual real gynecologist. I don't know. Like, I back then. Was gonorrhea treatable? I don't know.
I mean, they knew about it, so I'm sure they probably had. I don't know. This was also the probably, I mean, modern medicine was a thing. When was penicillin discovered? I want to say like it was about this time, right? Let's Wikipedia that real quick.
Okay, so since we're like Wikipedia and Googling a lot of things, I had to Google a lot during while I was reading this book, simply because I am a very visual person. And I just wanted to see like how people dressed at that time. I wanted to see like how different Parsis looked from Bengalis. I mean,
there's an appendix at the end of the
I read it on my phone. So I didn't see the last page until I reached the last page. And the cry of frustration I had, it was, oh my gosh. If only I had read that like before I started reading the book, it would have been really helpful. Right.
Looks like penicillin was discovered in 1928.
So not quite yet.
Not quite yet, but I want to say like medical science was probably a thing by now. They weren't, you know, bleeding people anymore, or at least not as much. But they knew how to diagnose it. So I think they probably knew what it was. Like, who knows what the actual treatment was, but I mean it's a good thing that she only had gonorrhea, I guess, and not also syphilis.
This was before condoms.
Probably.
I mean, there was like that stupid like sheep intestine condom that British people use, but obviously that's, you know, that's kind of gross.
Yeah, this was pre-birth control probably. So I don't know. Maybe it was me reading too much into it, but it really, I mean, I think Alice definitely has a crush on Praveen.
Maybe.
Right.
It's hard to tell. I do want to read the sequel, and I do want to read the third book that's coming out this year, because I am invested in Praveen. I'm invested in the other characters as well. And, yeah. You know, like, because, like, it's going to go forward, like, time's going to move forward. It's early 1920s now, but I don't know like when the third book is taking place.
Yeah, you're heading towards like the partition and then independence in like the 1940s, and there's a lot of meat there. But there's also a lot of like, I think, like we said, a lot of the fun of reading this book was getting immersed in these cultures that we're not, at least me and you, we are not familiar with, and learning the intricacies and learning the nuances and how they all intersect. I think that was why this book was so fun to read. And these days when you're getting a lot of reboots, right? I want to see, much like the Rian Johnson movie Knives Out was like a take on the murder mystery that was fresh, I feel like this is also the same thing, like a take on the classic cozy mystery, murder mystery, but from a fresh perspective that makes the whole thing different. And yeah, I think I'm the same as you. I would definitely read the second book when I have, you know, a free moment, which I have plenty of these days, and see what happens next with Praveen. Because I think in the Books and Boba pantheon of...
it's a pantheon now.
of unassuming investigators. Where does Praveen rank for you?
Okay, so what? There's Mimi Lee. There's There's Maserai. There's
Detective Galileo.
Detective Galileo, who's not really a detective, who's a mathematician. No, who's a physicist, I think. Some kind of science professor. And then who else? IQ, and that's it in terms of mysteries.
I guess. Would you consider Cass Russell a detective, or she's more of like a Bourne?
Yeah, she's more of like it's more action. So yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Mimi Lee is definitely at the bottom of when it comes to efficient investigating. Well,
she wasn't a good investigator. I mean, she was actually a terrible detective.
She was terrible. But chasing that's
down
what made
like every single. Yeah, she like chased down every single red herring she could find. So in terms of like skill as an investigator, not very good.
So Mimi Lee, I would say Maserai above that. Maserai was like really good at investigating too, but I just preferred Praveen's like method of using the law as a weapon on her side.
Well, because Masaryk didn't want to, right? He spent the whole time complaining about it. He was a good investigator in spite of himself.
Yes. IQ. Huh. Okay, so like my ranking is Galileo, IQ, Pervin, Masaryk, Mimi Lee.
I would probably switch IQ with Pervin.
I can see that. Because yeah.
Pervin, I would hang out with Pervin. I don't know if I would hang out with IQ. Kind of seems like a jerk.
Like in terms of investigative techniques,
Right. Yeah. Based on skill, I would probably hire IQ.
Yes.
Over Pervin.
I really like the ending, by the way. Speaking of like hanging out with Pervin in this book, like when they're outside the hotel, the Taj Mahal hotel.
Oh yeah, it's a very girl power moment.
Like the waiter is like, oh, we don't serve alcoholic drinks to women during the day.
Single women.
Yeah, to a single woman during the day because it makes the other guests uncomfortable.
and then she proceeded to lawyer them.
I thought it was really.
Yeah.
Girl power moment. I loved it. I loved the ending.
I mean, the last line was literally girl power, right?
To women.
Yeah. Any other final thoughts?
I thought it was the perfect book to read for this month, as a lot of people in our Goodreads forum said. I really like historical mystery series. I'm really glad that I found one that... that takes place in somewhere in Asia where it's an Asian detective and not some white old lady who's like pro-colonialism and whatnot. I really like the genre of historical mysteries because you don't have modern technology and you have to go through so many obstacles that we don't have today. I mean, sexism exists for sure today. But back then, it was a lot worse and a lot of navigating to do. So I think historical mysteries, they have more creative problem solving. So that's a genre that I really like. And I think Sujata Massey did an incredible job balancing the origin story with the murder mystery and also like the research that she did to make the place a character.
I feel the same way. I think I love that the way, as someone who enjoys mysteries, and have read quite a few for this book club, I like the way that she takes the trappings of the murder mystery and subverts it in very clever ways, whether it's flipping characters, using the setting, but while also using the building blocks of a murder mystery in the story. Again, I was very, very impressed by the revelation that the house that we've seen throughout the entire story was a murder house with secret passages. I thought that was, my mind is still blown right now, just thinking about how like that was revealed. Very well done. And yeah, definitely looking forward to checking out the next few stories when I have the time. And with that, that'll do it for our discussion of our July 2020 book club pick, The Widows of Malabar Hill. By Sujata Massey. Rira, thanks again for picking such a fun read. Definitely a good change of pace. Coming up, what are we reading for August 2020?
So our August 2020 book club pick is The Empress of Salt and Fortune by Ni Vo. It's a novella, so it's only around like 120 pages, I would say. Very short book. And it's fantasy. If you couldn't guess from the title, we haven't visited fantasy in a while, so I'm excited to jump back into that genre.
Yeah, excited to take a look, and excited that it's a shorter read. It'll give me time to catch up on other stuff that I'm reading as well. Coming up this month, we have a bunch of author interviews lined up, so expect some extra content from Books and Boba. But until then, thanks so much for listening. Tell us what you thought about The Widows of Malabar Hill by going to our Goodreads group and letting us know in the forum. Rira, thanks again for discussing books with me.
No problem.
Thanks for reading, everybody.
All right, bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
But we're still here and we're going strong.
It's an exciting time in Asian America. There are more movies, TV shows, books, and music reflecting us than ever. But all of these represent just a small slice of Asian American culture and experiences. So what do? Tell more slices. Asian Americana is a show that explores these slices of distinctly Asian American culture and history. We've talked about how Chinese Americans built California's Sacramento Delta, the art scene turns gallery institution giant robot, a play that explores the lost Cambodian pop music of the 60s and 70s, and, of course, Boba, just to name a few stories. You can find Asian Americana at asianamericana.com or on your podcast app. And we're getting tired of proof.